So I would encourage you to take a look at those. For one of the papers, there have been considerable amount of press, including a press release by the NIH, and which was picked up by a whole lot of agencies. And so that's a good place to start. And I was hoping that we'd have a chance to talk about some basic mechanisms in science today as well.
But we're not scientists, so.
But the question is, can I explain it? It's a, I tell my students they have to be able to explain what they do in 15 minutes at the Thanksgiving Day table to their parents and relatives.
Okay. First of all, could you please briefly, for the record, tell us your role with the ASM, please?
So I have been, this is my third year as vice chair.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Pardon me?
Your name?
Okay. So I'm Jeff Miller. I'm the chairman of the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Molecular Genetics at UCLA Medical School. And I am also, for 3 years now, the vice chair of this ASM general meeting, and will be the chair for the next 3 years of the general meeting.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thanks. We discussed briefly the other day how phages can be designed to mimic human immune responses to invaders. Could you please expand a little bit more on that, please?
Sure. It's not so much, at least initially, that we have designed phages to mimic the immune response, but nature has endowed some phage with the ability to mimic the immune response. And the way the system works is very similar to the way the immune system works. We protect ourselves against foreign antigens by generating random diversity in the cells called B cells that produce antibody molecules. And we have a whole collection of these in our body, most of which are never used. But when an antigen comes along that will bind, just by chance, one of those B cells, that cell is activated, it divides, and it produces antibodies, which may protect us from a bacterial pathogen or a viral pathogen, et cetera. And so the steps in this process are a genetically encoded diversity generator that we have in our cells, in our immune cells, which generates diverse populations of cells which are selected and amplified for a specific property. And the size of this diverse repertoire is staggering, anywhere from 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 17 or so cells in the human body. So what has happened in these phage is very interesting, a very similar type of phenomenon. We noticed many years ago that there were bacteriophages that were able to change their receptors, essentially the feet they used to land on top of a bacterial cell, to select different molecules on the surface of a pathogen. And it turned out, after a lot of molecular studies, that that ability is due to a mechanism that generates diversity, that incorporates that diversity into the protein that binds the surface of the bacterial cell, and allows the phage to change that according to what the bacterial cell is doing or expressing on its surface. And so what these actually are essentially smart antimicrobials. And if the bacterium becomes resistant to the phage by changing that surface receptor, the phage is smart enough to be able to change itself and to find another receptor on that same bacterial cell. And so the problem with antibiotics is that they are static and the target, the bacteria, can change to evade them, to no longer be susceptible to them, but the antibiotic can't change unless we synthesize a new derivative. In contrast, these naturally occurring antimicrobials, i.e. bacteriophage, have evolved a way to keep one step ahead of the potential resistance that may be generated by the host bacterial cell.
Are these just very specialized families of phages that can do this, or is this a feature common to a lesser or certain degree with all phages?
Good question, and I think there's a general answer to this. Once nature has invented a useful mechanism, she tends to use it over and over again. And so we have a genetic signature of this ability. And we find it in bacteriophage and affect Bordetella, which cause whooping cough. We also find it in bacteria that affect Vibrio species, that inhabit the world's oceans. We find it in other bacteriophage. And interestingly, we also find it in bacterial chromosomes themselves, not phage-associated. And so this is essentially a diversity-generating cassette. We call it a diversity-generating retroelement that appears in various places in various types of organisms, including bacteriophage. Mm-hmm. And what it essentially does is changes binding characteristics of proteins that associate with ligands to perform a function. A lot of biology is based on a protein binding another protein, or a carbohydrate, or DNA, or RNA, or another molecule. Recognition is one of the most essential features of biology. When we make drugs, in most cases, they will bind to a receptor which recognizes that drug or its natural ligand and alter the activity. And so it's a fundamental process. It was completely an accidental discovery. We weren't looking for it. We found it by serendipity. And it has fascinated us for the last 5 years or so in my laboratory.
Interesting. Thank you very much. you also mentioned a bit about how can phage tails be used to kill bacteria, not the head. Could you expand on that, please?
Sure. So there's a lot of interest in using bacteriophage as antimicrobials. And the applications range from environmental decontamination, protecting the food supply, as well as human and animal therapeutics. And certainly phage have enormous promise in all of those areas. There are, however, some limitations of phage. And one limitation, for example, is there are multiple steps along the pathway at which a bacterium can become resistant to a phage. Another potential question about phage for therapeutics is when bacteriophage escape from the bacterial cell, that cell is destroyed as lysed, and bits and pieces can activate the immune system. So the pieces can sometimes be more harmful in terms of activating the immune system in a negative way than the whole bacterium itself. And in addition, bacteriophage are important agents of evolution. They can move genes between bacterial cells, including antibiotic genes, and including virulence determinants. And this is called transduction. And then finally, there's a question regarding public acceptance of a virus. And even though it is a bacterial virus, it's safe. We know that public perception and public misperception can have an enormous impact on science and efforts to use science to the benefit of the public. This happened with vaccines. It happens with genetically modified food, radiation, etc. So what pioceins are these amazing inventions that probably go back a billion or more years ago, where bacteria have essentially captured in their genomes not entire phage chromosomes, but the part of a bacteriophage that encodes what's called the tail. And this is where a whiteboard would come in handy. And what happens with bacteriophage is some classes will bind to the surface of a bacterium and inject a tube across a bacterial cell surface through which the viral genome, the viral DNA, travels into the bacterial cell. The phage then turns that bacterial cell into a factory for making more bacteriophage, which then escape and lyse and replicate. The advantage being exponential multiplication of the antibacterial. What a pioceid is essentially just the tail with no head and no DNA. It's all protein. And it will bind with enormous affinity to a bacterial cell, inject a tube. But there's no DNA, no head, and nothing to plug the hole. And what that does is pokes a single hole in the surface of the bacterium. It disrupts the ability of the bacterium to make energy by depolarizing the membrane, and it will kill a bacterial cell. One particle is sufficient to kill a bacterial cell, and they do so with amazing efficiency. And these have essentially evolved to be extremely efficient killing machines that bacteria use as part of their warfare with other microbes in the environment.
So I could explain a bit, what is this is, I thought this pioceid was a used by the phage, not by the bacteria?
No, the pyosin is present in the bacterial cell.
Oh, I see.
So the bacterial cells have this ability to deploy this weapon. When they do so is when they are under conditions of stress and competition in their environment. They sense that, and they turn on the genes that produce this entity. Mm-hmm. And a few bacterial cells in a population will send off these destructive pyosins, their weapons, to then kill the bacteria that are competing with them and supply them with nutrients or competition space. And so it's a example of the effort that bacteria have, or the ability bacteria have, to outcompete their competitors. And in fact, nature is full of these very potent non-antibiotic-like antibacterial factors that are only now beginning to be exploited. So what we're looking at is an invention of nature, and a very efficient invention that has had eons to evolve and optimize. And we now have the ability to genetically engineer these to change their specificity, to expand their specificity, to take one from Pseudomonas and engineer it to infect an E. coli or to kill Yersinia pestis. And so the combination of nature's experiments over billions of years and our perhaps naive but seemingly powerful ability to genetically engineer, to manipulate according to our own design, now makes these a very interesting potential tool. How they differ is that they are not viruses. There's no DNA. They can't transfer antibiotic resistance at a low frequency between one bacterium or another. The FDA likes the ability to dose a drug. And how do you dose an exponentially amplifying drug like a bacteriophage? Mm-hmm. Right? These are quantifiable. And so in association with a company called Avid Biotics, we are very interested in developing these as a potential addition to the armamentarium against bacterial pathogens.
Fine, thank you very much, thank you. I don't know if you're aware of the Helsinki Agreement, Article 32. This is related to doctors and the way they treat their patients, which basically says that when all current therapies have failed, the doctors must discuss and suggest all other alternatives. Given that phage therapy has been used very successfully in the former Soviet Union for the last 80 years, why do you think doctors are not doing this, not giving this information to their patients?
I think there are probably several reasons, and I'd say first that the best person to ask would be an infectious disease physician at an academic medical center. My impression as a basic scientist is that one of the concerns is that these agents have to be well characterized in advance. You need to know what types of phage are these, how do they interact with the bacterial host, etc. It's also important to pick the right phage, obviously, for the bacterial pathogen. It's important for a given infection, which can be done by identifying the pathogen and doing the phage work in advance. I think that there is a reluctance to move to a therapeutic that has not been vetted in the Western literature, and in fact the high-profile literature. And so as very carefully controlled studies are done with phage, and these are published in journals of extremely high quality and reputation, that there will be an enthusiasm for exploring this avenue. But what the physician needs is an assurance that whatever the treatment is has the possibility of being efficacious. Therefore, it has to be a well-characterized treatment for this to be considered, especially for a patient that is in such dire straits.
Mm. Don't you think the empirical evidence of the use successfully in the former Soviet Union might be enough to at least compel them to take a look?
Certainly. I think it
when you consider things like Manuka honey and other sort of classical, well-researched over historical thousands of years treatments, which are slowly being used, recognized now as being useful therapies.
I think it is definitely compelling. But I think the key word is empiric. You know, what empiric implies is experimentation. It's a hypothesis that's tested by an experiment. Mm-hmm. And there are very high standards for what is considered acceptable clinical evidence for an intervention, whether it be an antibiotic or a bacteriophage. And so that is what is badly needed. We have to encourage and support studies that evaluate ways to use phage for all infections, and especially those that are so life-threatening. Mm.
So you think it's basically the lack of evidence in science which is making them reluctant to look at this?
I think it's a lack of rigorously vetted data, published science in peer-reviewed journals that is currently the problem. The good news is that can be changed. And the way you change it is by having those first few studies come out in the very best medical literature that are rigorous as well as compelling.
Mm, thank you. You mentioned earlier that toxic debris can be released from a bacteria when it's lysed by a phage. Would this be more or less harmful than the toxins released from when a phage is killed by an antibiotic?
When a bacterium is killed by an antibiotic. There are some antibiotics that will induce lysis. And in fact, this is an area that is under careful examination by the infectious disease community. Should anti-inflammatories accompany antibiotic therapy? But if you think about it, there's a double-edged sword, because what you would ideally like is for the immune system to partner with an antibiotic to kill a bacterial pathogen. It's advantageous to have both. And so if you use an anti-inflammatory to suppress that type of an immune response, mm-hmm. You also compromise an important partner in the effort to mm-hmm. eliminate the bacterial pathogen. And so this is an area that there are many well-qualified experts in the infectious disease arena that would be able to comment in more detail on current research in that field.
Okay, fine, thank you. Also, I have questions about the strict regulatory hoops that most chemicals have to go through, because it's been, even though most chemicals have passed through the hoops, the real trial only starts when they're released upon the general public, mm-hmm. because that's when the huge numbers come in. Mm-hmm. And then there are well-documented cases of disasters, deaths, and many near-deaths, mm-hmm. despite them having passed the strict regulatory procedures.
Sure.
Given that phages have not been proved to have killed anybody,
right.
What is the difficulty? Why should the same strict regulatory procedures be applied to something which seems to be so benign, as opposed to something which is so potentially dangerous, like a chemical, which is not a natural substance for the body?
Mm-hmm. So as you know, the not uncommon scenario is for a therapeutic to make its way all the way through approval by the FDA, for example, on the basis of well-conducted studies. And then the numbers increase as it is used. And so we go from a situation where there are limited numbers that may give statistically significant data to a situation where there are much, much larger numbers, many more variables. And that's where you start to see some of the side effects, the problems that may be associated. And it's always a trade-off. There are probably no or very, very few drugs that are absolutely specific. And so side effects are obviously and probably necessarily common. With phage, there are some interesting issues, one being the problem in dosing, which we already talked about. Another would be the ability to isolate bacteriophage for use in humans that are relatively free of contaminants from the bacterial cell. And the reason is because those so-called contaminants can actually be recognized by the immune system and cause unwanted effects.
But sure.
So far, I'm not aware of any toxicity that's been associated with phage.
Yeah.
But one of the concerns would be things like allergy, for example. And there may be others, but they do at this point seem to be quite safe. They are also something that we ingest all the time as we eat our produce,
exactly,
et cetera. In terms of production, there is single molecules that are purified and characterized are more palatable to the regulatory agencies than structures that have a composition of 60 different proteins plus DNA, because they are much more complicated. There's much more there. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the FDA responds to requests to approve phage or parts of phage for use in humans. As you know, in August, the FDA approved use of listeria phage for decontamination of food, which is a very interesting first step. And now there are many of us that are very eager to see how the FDA is going to respond to well-written and well-documented proposals to approve bacteria phage for clinical studies. I don't think we know. There's a lot of speculation one way or the other. But personally, I was very surprised by the approval in August. And so it may be that some of the reluctance may or may not be well-founded in terms of what the reality is. My impression is that there are people at the FDA that are open-minded and curious and would actually enjoy having a chance to vet this issue.
See, the status quo has never changed anything in medical science. It's always the what-ifs. The mavericks, the one-offs, they're the only ones that push forward change. Status quo is actually a backward step.
Right. And I think, so we'll have to see. I don't think there's any reason for pessimism until that proves necessary.
It seems like the regulatory mechanism is like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. You're using something designed to keep dangerous drugs out of people's bodies.
Right.
All these drugs that don't work. And you're applying the same, or the FDA is applying the same regulations to something which has never been shown to harm anybody.
That's right.
And that's Hippocrates' first principle, first do no harm.
Do you know if the FDA has refused legitimate proposals yet for phage?
I don't know.
I don't know that. And in fact, it would be interesting to look at, because I don't know that they have. I don't know that they have ever received what would pass, muster as a formal application for phage therapy. I don't know, but I would really be interested in knowing.
That is a question that I can simply write and ask.
Yes.
Yeah.
And similarly with the MHRA, they, in England, from the correspondence that I've had, they're basically saying, okay then, if somebody puts in an application for a license, we'll look at the packaging.
Yes.
We'll look at the proposed wording and take it from there. But until somebody takes that step, they can do nothing.
I had a discussion with a colleague at the FDA about this and was left with the impression that there are several people there that would actually enjoy having an opportunity to do something like this. So I'm not sure that there's a problem, or evidence of a problem.
The vibe you were getting from them was quite...
Yes, but the question is, have there been applications that have gone forward and gotten rejected?
Exactly.
That's what you want to know, specifically.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know the answer to that question. My suspicion is the answer is no. I don't know that. And I think you should find out. And then tell me what the answer is.
Yeah.
Right? I need to find that information.
Yeah, I did hear a dentist or a dental company had patented... apply for a patent for a phage to attack mutants, which is the first bacteria to recolonize the teeth,
right.
And then all the bacteria apparently stick to it or build up on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's happening about that. It's just a little Google alert I heard.
Just see what the FDA has received. That must be publicly available information, I would guess.
Thanks.
It's not going to do any harm to simply send them an email and just ask
them
perfectly innocently.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.